This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
By his own admission, Stephen Mikulak is an ordinary man who leads an ordinary life. But in 1967, Mikulak claims that his life was turned upside down when he had an extraordinary encounter with a mysterious flying craft. For many years, A.J. Bro was a fixture in the small community of Houma, Louisiana. Then suddenly in 1991, he simply vanished. A mysterious note sent to the police suggested that he had accidentally killed himself while drinking. But at least three eyewitnesses are positive they saw Bro in the weeks after he disappeared. California's Frontera Prison is one of the largest women's penitentiaries in America. But over the past decade, the deaths of a prison guard and an inmate have led to controversial allegations of corruption inside the prison walls. Join me for these intriguing stories and a heartwarming update on another edition of Unsolved Mysteries. Every year, there are thousands of reports of unidentified flying objects. As a rule, people who admit to having an encounter with a UFO open themselves to ridicule and derision. Some will call them crazy. Others will openly accuse them of concocting a hoax. In this story, the person involved is a simple, unassuming man who was always skeptical about UFOs until he had his own close encounter. Stephen Mikulak and his wife came to Manitoba, Canada from Poland after the Second World War. Stephen found work as an industrial mechanic in a cement plant, and life was happy and uneventful for nearly 20 years. Stephen was an amateur rock hound who spent every spare moment in the beautiful natural woodlands of Manitoba.
I love nature, I love birds, animals. And also I have interest in nature, so rocks and this and that. Every weekend, in the long weekend, I usually travel, go to the out in the country and snooping in the rocks.
On May 20th, 1967, Stephen was prospecting approximately 100 miles east of Winnipeg. Suddenly, he was distracted when a flock of geese in the pond below kicked up an unusual racket.
Looking on the tree, I notice a two cigarette-like shape things with the hump in the middle. I said, what the hell is that? One stay in the air, and the other one is coming down, down, down. I start looking for marks. I never see a UFO or NASA or something written on it, no. Nothing, I didn't see anything on it. But still I was thinking that probably experimenting vehicle from United States.
Stephen Mikulak says that he made this sketch of the strange craft just after he saw it land.
I do remember one description that he gave at the time. He said that the skin of the craft, the outside of the craft, was flawless. There were no
Stan Mikulak was 10 years old in 1967.
No, nothing. It was as though you had milled out of a solid block of steel this disc, this saucer with the dome on top.
Stephen Mikulak told his son that after a few moments, the door of the craft slowly opened.
When the gate opened, there was a giri, 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 kind of shrieky talk like a kid in problem or something. Thinking of USA, I said, okay, Yankee boys.
A Yankee boy.
Seems to me you are in trouble.
Yankee boy. You got troubles, I'll help you.
When his English received no response, Stephen tried Russian.
Я вам помогу.
Then Polish.
Ну, выходите, пожалуйста. Я помогу вам. Пожалуйста.
And finally, German.
Deutsch? Sprechen Sie Deutsch vielleicht? Kommen Sie heraus, ich werde helfen Ihnen. Bitte. Kommen Sie heraus. Ich werde helfen Ihnen.
Stephen says that as he drew nearer the door, the light was so bright he had to snap down the visor on his safety goggles. After a few moments, the door suddenly shut. According to Stephen, the craft rotated counterclockwise, knocking him backwards and setting his shirt on fire.
After igniting with the fire, the craft lifts up 30 to 40 feet and vanished. And then I decided, I said, now is the time for me to buzz off from here, go out. So I started going.
He started feeling strange and threw up several times. At the same time, he was experiencing spots in front of his eyes, which could be after effects from the brilliant lights emanating from what appeared to be ducts or ports in the top of the alleged craft.
When Stephen checked his compass, trying to find his way southeast to the road, he says the needle went haywire. Disoriented and badly burned, Stephen took his best guess at the direction. 9 hours later, he finally arrived back home in Winnipeg, where his story made local headlines and apparently left doctors baffled.
At that point in time, the diagnosis, if you can call it that, was burns. And sure, they were burns, yes. Heat caused burns. What they couldn't diagnose and didn't have a clue about was what appeared below the chest, on the abdomen. The exact same pattern of holes that was on the grid on the side of the craft, in the same order, in the same rows, in the same number, appeared as red spots on his lower abdomen, red dots.
Stephen was released from the hospital, but he says his symptoms worsened. The nausea continued, and his body seemed to emit a sulfuric stench.
There was this sulfur ozone electric burning motor stink about him. It's like he's carrying the aura of this smell. Wherever you walked and he got close to you, you could smell this. Not baths, showers wouldn't take it out. That lasted for weeks. I remember seeing him in bed constantly, tired, nauseous, headachy, not feeling well, losing a lot of weight.
Stephen Mikulak was tested for radiation poisoning. The results were negative. Yet no one could explain the source of the strange burns on his torso.
The physicians were actually unable to determine many of Mikulak's ailments. They knew, for example, he was physically thermally burned. His chest was burned and singed. But the pattern lower down on his chest was very, very unusual. It was eventually determined that it was a chemical burn, not a radiation burn, although he did have some symptoms that might have suggested to some people that some sort of radiation effects might have been involved.
On June 30th, 6 weeks after the encounter, Stephen and a friend went looking for the site.
Bob, come, quick.
After several hours, they found a burned-out circle with a radius of more than 15 feet.
This is it. I knew it. I told you.
On this barren patch of rock was a circular, roughly circular ring of vegetation, dead pine needles, dirt, leaves, that sort of thing. The rock had been swept clean except for this ring which was surrounding this area. They'd also noticed that a few of the trees appeared to have dead branches, as if something had either come in and touched them or brushed by them with an intense heat or some other effects.
Within days, a team of experts from the United States working in cooperation with the Royal Canadian Air Force converged on the site. They took measurements, cataloged soil samples, and checked for radiation. The levels appeared alarmingly high, and the health department considered quarantining the area. Later, however, they discovered that the high levels were caused by a vein of radium which ran under the entire region.
Mr. Nicolai, this is my colleague, Dr. Shaw.
Doctor.
He's a radiologist.
Meanwhile, Stephen's burns, which had appeared to be healing, suddenly flared up again.
To examine these burns.
According to Stephen, his doctors remained mystified.
Shows he's not suffering from radiation poisoning.
After every 3 months, my burns from legs and here were coming back, showing up again and burning. And burning and vomiting. Anything I eat, bingo, goes.
To this day, you can, if you let you, can press into his skin and feel subcutaneous scar tissue in the form of those burns on his chest, which he playfully calls his buttons. And it's there. You cannot deny this. This is there.
Look at these cracks.
On May 19th, 1968, 1 year after Stephen Mikulak's close encounter, he and a friend returned to the site.
Just about center, a little north of center, the Geiger counter rose very, very dramatically. At that point, within an 18-inch section of the crack, they scooped out a whole, almost half a jar full of what appeared to be molten rock or molten metal of some sort. Subsequently, we found out what it was, but at that time, it was unclear, but it was quite radioactive.
According to Ed Barker, an analysis revealed that the material was an extremely pure grade of silver that is difficult to obtain. It had been coated with pitch blende ore, which contains both uranium and radium.
This is what we found, three identical bars of what appear at first glance to be silver alloy of some sort. They were obviously manufactured somehow. It was considerably radioactive. Now it's perfectly safe to handle.
This is one of the biggest mysteries and one of the biggest puzzles. And skeptics have pointed to this as the reason why the case should be discounted. Why would particles and metal fragments of this size and radioactivity have been missed by all previous investigators? And this is one mystery that we don't have definite answers to this day.
By someone.
Ed Barker believes the silver was planted by someone who may have wanted to lend credence to Stephen Mikulak's story.
Planted on the site. Saying that, I do not believe Mikulak had anything to do with this, but I do believe that it was planted.
I'd like to think that one day we'll get a letter from the U.S. government and it'll say, we have the two craft in our hangar over here, and we were experimenting with them at the time. Sorry. And I'd want to go and see them. And I'm sure Dad would, too. And that would be great. What would be worse is to have this thing drag to a point and drag on where it's never explained.
Today, Stephen Mikulak is 76 years old. He and his wife continue to live in Manitoba. Stephen still is not sure what it was he saw back in 1967. He says doctors had never been able to explain the burns on his chest or the mysterious symptoms which resembled radiation poisoning. Since no other explanation is forthcoming, Stephen Michalak is willing to entertain the notion, no matter how far-fetched, that he saw something not of this earth. When we return, allegations of murder and cover-up inside one of America's largest prisons for women. Frontera Prison, 45 miles south of Los Angeles, California, one of the largest women's penitentiaries in America. Frontera's maximum security wing houses some of California's most dangerous female offenders. Yet it is the alleged criminal activities of some guards and administrators that has shoved Frontera into the public spotlight. In recent years, former prison employees have made sensational allegations of widespread drug trafficking at the prison. They have tied these charges of corruption to a pair of seemingly isolated incidents. The disappearance and subsequent murder of a Frontera guard, Justin Rich, in 1984, and the controversial death of an inmate named Terry Lucas 3 years later. In November of 1987, Lucas was found dead in Frontera's infirmary, where she was recovering from a cancer biopsy. To some, the incident appeared highly questionable. According to former Frontera guard Betty Thompson, an officer from another wing of the prison had approached Terry Lucas shortly before she died. The unauthorized visit apparently terrified the 25-year-old Lucas.
This was an inmate that came off as tough and mean and mouthy, but when she saw the officer walking down the hall, her whole demeanor changed. She was absolutely devastated by his presence.
Thompson claims that the officer was determined to unlock Terry Lucas's cell. He retreated only when Thompson threatened to report him.
You just can't come into an area where you're not allowed.
Most of the time, officers back officers. We don't back inmates. But in this particular instance, it was just almost automatic that I would stand in front of the door and not let him in there. After this officer left the area, I keyed the door and went in to talk to Terry Lucas in her cell. She said the officer scared her, and the reason he scared her is because it was to make her be quiet.
More respectable in the past.
And she tells me that she's got information, she's got evidence, she knows who was involved in the disappearance of Jesslyn Rich.
I can tell you who, I can tell you what. I got all the stuff. I can give you all the evidence you need.
Betty Thompson was stunned by Lucas's revelation that she knew the fate of Jesslyn Rich, the Frontera guard who had disappeared under strange circumstances in 1984. Jesslyn Rich was a 35-year-old divorced mother of two. While working at Frontera, she had maintained a straight-A average in criminology classes at night school. At the time of her disappearance, Jesslyn had reportedly grown concerned about drug dealing inside Frontera.
You want to dance it?
Jesslyn Rich was last seen on November 11th, 1984, at a country western bar where she and a friend, Marilyn Ault, were joined by two male acquaintances.
Work and school.
See, that's your problem. You gotta get out more and live life. That's what it's all about there.
And all of a sudden, she sits very still and looks almost past me to the front door.
Jesslyn, are you okay?
And I look at her, and her eyes drew wide and fearful looking. But I didn't look to the door. I just, for some reason, just didn't turn around. And then she came back into the conversation.
I'll be right back.
See you in the ladies' room.
Jesslyn, I'll keep you seat warm.
Okay.
As she turns around the corner to go down the hallway to the bathroom, a gentleman appears to me out of the side of my eye, going directly behind her. And that's the last I see her. Ever.
Jesslyn Rich literally vanished without a trace. Her family and friends launched an all-out search. To them, it seemed harshly out of character for Jesslyn to abandon her children and scrap her career aspirations. But police investigators said they had no evidence to support the family's belief that Jesslyn had been kidnapped and possibly murdered.
They made light of it, called us just distraught relatives, suggested that my sister had just ran off on a fling with some person, which is totally absurd given her work record of only being late once and a 4.0 grade point average student. It just was unheard of.
Gary Muntz tore apart his sister's house, searching for clues the police might have overlooked. When he sifted through Justin's trash, he found evidence that her knowledge of illegal activities at the prison had put her life in danger.
And inside in the plastic bag were many, many pieces of paper torn up very, very small. I picked up a few of these and I could tell that it was my sister's writing or printing. And they were apparently notes or letters to a friend of hers, a co-worker. And I figured that I would take them home and sort them out later.
The letter had been written to another guard at Frontera. Scrawled on the margin of the last page was Jesslyn's haunting recital of an apparent threat she had received from a co-worker, that anyone interfering with his drug activities would be taken care of. At the time, this letter was the only concrete evidence indicating that Jesslyn had met with foul play. 3 years later, the case had faded from public view. Then in 1987, the mystery was suddenly thrust back onto center stage when Terry Lucas told Betty Thompson she knew what happened to Jesslyn Rich.
I have the information about Jesslyn.
The morning after her extraordinary conversation with Lucas, Officer Thompson returned to the prison infirmary.
Terry?
When I walked over to touch her, I noticed that Terry was dead. I went out of the cell, and I went down to the nurse's station, and I told them what I had seen and what I knew, and the coldness of the room, that she was not covered, her eyes were open, her breakfast tray had not been touched, and the nurses told me they would take care of it.
Incredibly, Betty Thompson claims that the inmate's body remained in the cell for a full 3 days before the county coroner's office was called. According to Thompson, an official from the coroner's office was initially mystified by what he found. Betty claims there were blades of grass in Lucas's hair and multiple bruises on her face, ears, neck, and lower arms. Her right arm appeared to be broken.
He asked who killed this inmate, and he's saying that this inmate was murdered. He is saying that he sees evidence that she was suffocated with the pillow that had been under her arm that appeared to be broken.
Betty Thompson says that after the official met with high-level prison administrators in Lucas's cell, he had a sudden change of heart.
And he told me that we were not going to call it murder, and we were not going to say that she was laying there dead for 3 days. We were going to, in fact, say that she was actually laying there only 2 hours, and that the cause of death was actually complications due to diabetes.
Betty Thompson says as she refused to go along.
How many times do I have to tell you, Thompson? You can't put this information in your report. Now you know what you're supposed to write. Just do it.
Thompson maintains that one of her superiors demanded that she change her report on Terry Lucas's death.
You are not leaving this institution until you do as you are told.
According to Thompson, she was subjected to threats and intimidation for 6 grueling hours.
You can kiss your career with the Department of Corrections. Goodbye.
There was one high administrator that even made the comment that the same thing that happened to Jesslyn Rich could easily happen to me. At that point in time, I broke down and cried.
That's what this was all about, and I hadn't told anything what Terry Lucas had said. I hadn't told them anything about that part. And for him to bring up Jesslyn Rich and her disappearance, it said why Terry Lucas had died. It had definitely had something to do with that.
Thompson says she finally gave in and signed a false report that was typed for her.
But I added on the bottom that I had signed the document under duress and the document was untrue. To my knowledge, that document was ripped up. Another one was retyped saying the similar things that were on the first document and that my signature was forged.
Betty Thompson claims there were further attempts at intimidation. They began on her next shift with an anonymous phone call.
Infirmary, Officer Thompson.
Thompson, if you don't learn how to do things in the proper manner, you'll end up dead alongside some muddy ditch.
The following day, Thompson had an unnerving encounter.
Wait. Have you been receiving threatening phone calls?
What are you talking about?
Oh, like you might be found dead in a ditch one night?
At this point in time, the hair on the back of my neck just stood straight up. I was absolutely petrified because I knew that she knew what they were saying to me and that she was part of whoever was threatening me.
Thompson says a menacing calls and harassment continued for 7 months. Finally, in June of 1988, the threats turned to violence. Betty Thompson immediately called the police, who arrived at her home moments later.
As I was upstairs filing a police report about the shooting, a phone call came in, and I picked up the phone. It was a male voice, and he said, "Next time, we won't miss." The police officer saw my face and saw how upset I was. He included that in his report.
In 1990, the brewing scandal at Frontera was the subject of a series of front-page special reports in the Orange County Register. The articles supported insider accounts of drug dealing and corruption. That same year, Betty Thompson and five other guards testified before state Senate hearings on the alleged offenses at Frontera Prison. Prison officials declined to be interviewed for this story. However, Tip Kendall, spokesman for the California Department of Corrections, told an Unsolved Mysteries researcher, quote, "I'm not saying the things people are alleging didn't happen. There's just no evidence to support them," end quote. Next, thanks to our viewers, a woman framed by her stepfather has been reunited with a former deputy sheriff who came to her rescue when all else seemed lost. Recently, we brought you the poignant story of a woman named Kathy Williams Loving, who grew up in Chicago.
Let me out!
In 1961, when she was 14 years old, Kathy fell prey to the abusive sexual advances of her stepfather, a detective with the Chicago police. Kathy finally went to the authorities for help, but she was labeled incorrigible and detained, apparently because of her stepfather's influence. 4 months later, by order of a juvenile court, Kathy was remanded to a state training school. She was placed in the custody of a Cook County deputy sheriff to be transported. Kathy had no idea that this ride would become a remarkable turn of fortune.
When they put me in the back of that paddy wagon, I just started boo-hooing. I just got to it dawned on me then, nobody knows where I'm going. I don't know where I'm going. You know, this has to be hell.
I didn't do anything
wrong. She shoved it.
Yeah, I've heard that story before.
Alone and scared to death, Kathy began to blurt out her story.
I'm here because my stepfather was messing with me.
Your stepfather?
Yes, he was messing with me.
Messing with you how?
Touching me the way a man touches a woman.
By the time they arrived at the reform school, the deputy was convinced that the system had made a terrible mistake. He offered to help Kathy, and she gave him the names of two friends, Louise Gordon and Maisie Bell. They brought the case to the attention of state social workers.
Who was that you said you wanted me to call?
Ultimately, Kathy was declared an emancipated minor and released from the reformatory. But Kathy never forgot the unknown deputy who lent a helping hand when no one else would.
If I could find him, I just want to say to him that many people reach out for help and many are refused help. But because of the fact that I reached out to him and he acknowledged me and gave me the help that I needed, he gave me my life.
On the night we last broadcast this story, Kathy Loving's search for her unknown benefactor finally came to an end when former Deputy Sheriff Fred Lyle of Chicago called our telecenter. Lyle said he had watched the story on Unsolved Mysteries and remembered the incident vividly. That evening, Fred Lyle and an overjoyed Kathy Loving spoke on the telephone and made plans to meet as soon as possible. Today, Kathy lives in a well-appointed suburb of Atlanta, Georgia. On July 18, 1992, Kathy and several friends gathered to await the arrival of Fred Lyle and one of his daughters. For Kathy, it was a special occasion, which afforded her the opportunity to finally say thank you.
The first thing out of my mouth was, I said, I love you. I said, I have been waiting all these years to tell you that I love you, and I wanted to say thank you. So I knew that was him.
The celebration culminated with a homemade feast prepared by Kathy, which included Fred's favorite dishes.
And I want to thank all my friends for helping me to cook and prepare this meal. And thank you for the food. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Good. Very good.
Very good.
Now it's time to start eating them.
Eat macaroni and cheese first, because they told me.
I did. I see it already.
I want to see what your face looks like when you bite down on it. Let me see that smile.
Can I get more food?
Fred Lyle left the sheriff's department in 1965. He has four children and eight grandchildren. And meeting Kathy was like welcoming a new member to the family.
It's just something special, something never happened to me before. And I doubt if it ever happened again. But I can remember this one time. That's why I came down here. Well, I just wanted to see her and tell her thank you for finding me. Because it did something to me inside. To know that somebody somewhere down the line appreciated some of the things I did for them.
Strange being.
You finally have a daughter who can cook.
Dawn is one, too.
The lesson I learned with Fred was that when all else has failed, don't give up. Not to give up, but there's always a way. And Fred Douglas Lyle was my way. I can't say it enough times, he was my hero. I reached out one more time, I thought, and he reached back. And he is my light, and he is my rainbow. That's what I've been waiting to give him. And another one, too.
Next, a small-town businessman vanishes under mysterious circumstances. Houma, Louisiana, population 31,000, lies in the heart of Cajun country, steeped in the romance of backwater bayous and sweeping magnolias. A.J. Bro was a fixture in Houma. He had lived in town his entire life, raised three daughters, and worked in the same clothing store for more than 30 years. Everyone in Houma knew that A.J. Bro was a man you could depend on.
My dad came off as being very friendly. He was extremely nice. Anybody and everybody that knew him knew that if they needed something, that he was there to help them.
A.J. had not come by his reputation easily. For years, he had battled a drinking problem, a problem which eventually led to his arrest for drunk driving and contributed to the breakup of his marriage. However, by 1991, A.J. had conquered his demons and been sober for 8 years.
Who'd like to take care of the food?
Nearly every evening, A.J. could be found at the Easy Does It Club, a support group for people with drinking problems. A.J. was dedicated to sobriety and was available at any hour of the day or night to assist those who were in desperate need of help.
Once he got involved with the program, it changed his whole life. He became even more responsible and more dependable and more trustworthy and more of a friend because he was involved with more people.
The Easy Does It Club was headquartered in an old warehouse. On Wednesday, August 28, 1991, A.J. left the club at approximately 8:30 p.m.
Hello, A.J. How you doing?
Oh, fine. How are you?
A half an hour later, A.J. stopped at a convenience store to buy a quart of milk. He told the cashier that he was on his way home where he lived with one of his daughters. He never arrived.
Okay, I'll see you later.
2 days later, A.J.'s car was found abandoned in a park across the street from the club. His three daughters immediately drove to the scene.
When we got there, I had already called the police department to meet us. The car was locked, so we couldn't get in. And our immediate reaction was tears. We were very emotional, very scared. And Detective Nakhan, the detective working on the case, had appeared. When he got out of the car, we told him that we knew it was my dad's car because he had a cracked blinker plate in the front.
Are y'all sure this is your father's car?
My instinct told me that he was in the trunk, dead.
Detective Nakhan, do you think we could check the trunk? I think he might be in here.
I immediately thought foul play because it just wouldn't be like him to park his car where everybody could find it and everybody knows him and disappear.
But apparently that is just what A.J. Bro did. His body was not in the trunk. There was no sign of foul play, and a search of the park turned up nothing. The only clues were A.J.'s wallet and checkbook, which were found tucked beneath the front seat of his car. The entire town was mystified. A.J. Bro seemed the least likely person in Houma to disappear. Authorities launched an immediate investigation and distributed missing persons flyers throughout the state. Soon a number of witnesses came forward, witnesses who told intriguing tales of seeing A.J. Bro after he disappeared. On Friday, August 30th, the same day that A.J.'s car was found, a local resident named Kenneth Pellegrin claims that he ran into A.J. outside of a convenience store in Houma.
Hey, A.J., how's it going?
Okay.
It was a strange situation for me to see him then, because he didn't look the same as he always did. He was wearing like a flannel shirt, something like a lumberjack style, and the pants were loose-fitting, brown, very loose-fitting. It wasn't nothing neat. And he was wearing some old tennis shoes. So that struck me as wrong because of all the times I've known him since 7 years old, I have never seen him with his hair out of place or not dressed up neat. AJ was nervous. It was like he was being watched.
Kenneth Pellegrin also observed a red compact car parked in front.
So I noticed the car and they had three guys still sitting in it. But the engine was running, and he was on the phone looking towards their way. And when I came back out, A.J. was gone, the car was gone. Had I known he had been missing, he would have been found then because I knew who he was.
Soon after Ken Pellegrin called the office, I received another call from a witness who said that he saw A.J. in a car with three other gentlemen. It was a red, small, compact car. On a rural route about 8 miles out of town. He waved to A.J. Bro, but A.J. Bro did not wave back, and that's very uncharacteristic of A.J. not to wave back. So he didn't think of anything of it because A.J. he didn't know A.J. was missing.
It makes me think that definitely somebody knows something. If both of these gentlemen who know him from a good while back, one a lot longer than the other, have seen him, we know that they know what he looks like, and they both saw him in the same color car with three men in it. I'm pretty much convinced that somebody somewhere knows something.
For the next 2 weeks, there were no further sightings and no clues to AJ's disappearance. Then a chilling handwritten note came into the police station. It read, A.J. Bro, he was drunk at the time. Self-inflicted gunshot wound. Stomach. Drawstring cotton sack. Put in by friend. Rolled over steep grassy bayou bank. Near dam. The note was signed, Helene. The note painted a bizarre scenario in which AJ had been drinking and accidentally shot himself. Then someone, for some unknown reason, dumped his body in the bayou.
It just so happened where we found a car that described that area. So we called the sheriff's office, water patrol units in, and they dredged both sides of the dam on three different occasions, but weren't able to find anything.
Soon the case took another strange twist. Authorities received a surprising report which indicated that A.J. Breaux might still be alive. On September 28th, 4 weeks after A.J. disappeared, a woman named Christy Boudreaux was sitting on the front porch of her home in Lockport, Louisiana, 30 miles northeast of Houma.
I saw a van pass up and down the street two times, so I figured whoever was in the van was evidently lost. Then I saw him reach over the driver's seat into the middle of the van, and he picked up a bag. I didn't know what was in it till he got to my porch. And as he walked to me, he looked really nervous, and he was shaking. He wanted to know if I wanted to buy some frozen fish, and I told him no, and I smelled the alcohol on his breath, and he looked homeless, kind of straggly.
Okay, thanks anyway.
And as he got, I'd say 10 feet from me, he turned around and glanced at me. And that's when it hit me that I saw that man on a missing person flyer in the post office.
Christy, I have a picture here. I'd like you to look of A.J. Breaux. I met with Christy, and I showed her some photographs of A.J. One was a photograph of the flyer that was being distributed, and she wasn't too sure about that one. Then I showed her a photograph of a mugshot that we had of A.J. from when he was drinking, and she was almost certain that was A.J. Breaux then.
I mean, he was older, but he was skinnier, like in this picture.
I was almost certain that that was the man that had approached me while I was on my porch. And that's what I told the detective, that I was 99.9% sure that that was Mr. Breaux.
A.J. Breaux is a recovering alcoholic. And if he did start drinking again, and there's all sorts of things that could have happened. He could have had a blackout and not remember who he is.
AJ's family, however, refuses to believe that he has turned to alcohol once again and disappeared by choice. Because AJ's wallet and checkbook are found in his car, they are convinced that he was abducted.
When I think back to what happened or why things may have happened, in my mind, I go back to the fact that his car was found at the park. What happened when he got there, I'm not sure, but I'm wondering if he may have seen something or heard something that he wasn't supposed to see or hear.
A few days after AJ's disappearance, a golf course maintenance worker had called the city police. He reported that he had seen three men forcing a fourth man into a white automobile in the park where AJ's car was found. But the details were sketchy, and nothing ever came of it. What really happened to A.J. Breaux? While there is some evidence that he may have been abducted, there is no indication as to why someone would kidnap him. And authorities now suspect that the note detailing A.J.'s accidental suicide was a mean-spirited prank.
A.J. Breaux at this time is still listed as a missing person. We have no evidence of foul play. But of course, we have no evidence that he just got up and left either. So we really don't know what happened to A.J.
It's not like him to disappear and not notify us. The last year, it's been about a year since my dad's been missing, and it's been a very long year. It feels like forever. It's been torture, very hard, and we want it to end.
A.J. Breaux is 51 years old. He is 5 feet 11 inches tall and weighs approximately 155 pounds. He has brown eyes and brown hair. A.J. was last seen on August 28, 1991. On our next Unsolved Mysteries, as a POW during the Vietnam War, Colonel Charles Shelton's legendary resistance earned the respect of even his captors. Back home in America, his family's persistence has been no less inspiring. For more than 25 years, they have fought to prove that Charles Shelton was still alive long after the war was over. Because of their efforts, Colonel Shelton is the only remaining POW not presumed dead by our government. Join us next week for this timely and heartrending story as we commemorate Veterans Day on Unsolved Mysteries.